Yesterday, I introduced ideas of quantum error correction. And then we need three main things to talk about if we want to think about quantum error correction. First, you need to know the noise. If you don't know the noise, then there's no way you can fight it. And how do we know this? We've seen this when we talked about quantum operations. Krauss operator is one way we can think about noise. And what we're going to focus on is the polarizing channel, for example, or Z errors. So one of the two. The polarizing channel, in some sense, is the analog of when we look at the classical noise. You remember the 0 and 1 could go to 0s and 1. There was a P and a Q, and I said, oh, well, just take P equal to Q to make things simple. In some sense, the depolarizing noise is the same thing. I just say X, Y, Z happen with the same rate, and there's no coherence between X and Y and Z. So there's only one parameter in the depolarizing noise, and you know by now that you would need 12 of them to have a generic non-unitary evolution. So we have to define the noise. Well, I'm going to switch between Z errors and this. Then we talk about encoding and error correction. And what I argued is that the idea between the error correction and the encoding is to find a state. So under the action of the noise, we can find an operation which invert or finding the inverse of the noise. And the equivalent of this equation is something which looks like this. And I gave you an explanation of what this equation means. And so if they are satisfied, I argue that you could find the inverse. You could invert it. Okay. And then I gave an example of one particular type of code, the one we correct for Z error. So if we assume that we have the operation which is either 1 with some probability, and I haven't put the probability in here, but to be correct with Krauss operator, I should say some this happens with probability 1 minus 3p, for example, square root of p, square root of p, square root of p, so that the sum of these thing daggers when you square it sums to 1. So you have either nothing happened, z1, z2, or z3, which can affect this here where the noise comes in. And what we've shown is that with this particular encoding, when there's only one error, you can do the decoding. Okay, and when you decode, then the state factorized between what we call the syndrome, the thing which tells us which errors occurred, and the state which might have been modified. And in this particular case here, if you do this this way, the decoding is the inverse. There was a control, control not, which is going to bring all the states back. And if there's only one error, then we recover the exact quantum information. Okay. If there's more than one error that occurs, suppose there's z1 and z2 that occur, then this piece will become minus, minus, and plus, and we won't be able to do this, and we would not be able to correct this. So if there's more than one error, and if the errors are independent from qubit to qubit, which is usually the case in reality, or often the case in reality, you won't be able to correct them. There will be a probability of 0 error, probability of 1 error, probability of 2 errors, probability of 3 errors. But it will go down with values of p. Okay? And if they go down, then what does the error correcting code does is that it takes p and turns it to 3p squared. And if p is small enough, then it's worthwhile. In a few minutes, I'll show you an experiment which does that, which shows some gain by doing error correction, and I'll tell you the pitfalls of that experiment. Okay? Questions? The next thing we did is we introduced a stabilizer. And I just want to review this. And the idea of the stabilizer is that we're going to look at errors which are tensor product of polymatrices. Okay? So Obviously, when you have only Z errors, they'd be one and Z's, that's easy. But if we look at two qubits, we could say, look at one, X, and Z. So you could have an error, which is P1, tensor 1. This is a no error, but you could have X tensor Z as one error. And it turns out that looking at this has a lot of nice machinery in mathematics, which allows us to find a lot of different codes. And this is called the stabilizer formalism. So P to the N is a group of the tensor product of Pauli matrices. So let's say for two qubit, this is one of the 16. This is a group because if you multiply them, they remain tensor product of Pauli matrices. Okay. Now, if you would take this and rotate x by just a quarter of an angle, then you'll get a superposition, let's say, of x and plus y. In some sense, in the block sphere, when we multiply by these elements of the group, it's always rotation of 90 degrees in the block sphere. So x goes to y or z or things like this, so they rotate within themselves. Okay. Now, once we have this, we define the stabilizer as a set of operator such that m on the code, a set of operators which have eigenvalue 1 on a code. Okay, so here we have our code, and we're like looking at what are the set of operators that have eigen 1. Any guess? So you remember that if you take x on plus, what do we get? X on plus, which is x on 0 plus 1. X on 0 gives you 1. X on 1 gives me 0. Give me plus. So plus is an eigenstate of x with eigenvalue 1. X on minus. Okay, so minus is an eigenstate of x with minus. You knew this. It's just a little bit outside of context, and then you're a bit surprised. So now let's find some operator with x in there, which are eigenstate of this. So if I have only one x, it's not going to work, because when I have this, I'll have a minus. So give me another operators which are have x's in there. So x1, x2, and it will be OK. And x1 and x3 would be another one. So we can think of other states here. Bring my state over there, and my m's would be these two, okay? And if you look at this, this as if you look in the Hilbert space, it'll have states which have eigenvalues positive, eigenvalues negative, and they're always one if you have tensor product of Pauli operators, because x squared is equal to one. Or any Pauli matrix or tensor Pauli matrix that you square is equal to 1. So the square of the eigenvalues has to be 1. So if you take the square root, you have, it'll be 1 or minus 1. Okay. So every time you have an operator like this, it divides the Hilbert space in 2. We divide it in 2 in here and 2 in here, but the whole Hilbert space is 8. So there's a two-dimensional Hilbert space left, which is spanned by that state. Okay. So the stabilizer, we're thinking about a set of operators, okay? And we can invert this idea of instead of looking at this, and it turns out, I should have mentioned also, that measuring these two operators here and there, in fact, if you would have looked carefully, you had found the answer here, the question I had, the result of these measurements on the state that has been corrupted is going to be a set of parities. I can call them plus or minus or zero and ones, and these are the syndrome of our quantum error-correcting code. And you'll see this appearing in a few seconds again. If I have a state, I can find the operators that have eigenvalue 1, or I can define, if I give you a set of m, a stabilizer, then I can tell you, find the state, the subspace s, so T of S, so that M on this operator that I'm giving you, what are these psi? So I could have given you this and say, what is a subspace? And with a little bit of work, you would have found this piece here. We can look at what is the dimension of this space. Okay, we're going to say it's 2 to the k because we are dealing with qubits. And k turns out to be n, the number of qubits, minus r. And r is the number of generators of s, or the number of elements in s. And here we have 2. So indeed, 2 minus 3 minus 2 is equal to 1 in a two-dimensional space. So that works well with this. It agrees. Now, if you take another element of Pn, I give you an m, okay? And you have your stabilizer, and then I'm going to look at some other operator. Let's call it E. E will have one of these two properties with the generators M. Either they will commute, or they will anti-commute. So let's do one example. If I have x1, x2, and I'm looking at this part of is my M, and I take E is equal to x1, then it commutes. But if I have a z in there, or a y in one of the two qubits, or one of the three qubits, it will anti-commute. Okay? And if you take any tensor product of Pauli matrices, it will either commute or anti-commute. That's a property of that group. Okay? If it commutes, and we look at this code, it's an eigenstate plus 1. And if it anti-commute, state minus 1, an eigenstate of the TS. Okay? So now, if you look at our errors here, z1, z2, z3, it will anti-commute with at least one of those. Okay? So z1 anti-commute with both of them. Z2 anti-commute with this. Z3 anti-commute with that. Okay? So okay. Sorry about this. The gods disagreed with what I said. Okay, so I think I was saying that if you take the errors here, the anti-commutes with one of those, then there's a one-to-one correspondence between this property about anti-commutation and not and the syndrome. So the idea of a syndrome for an error that could be E is to look at if they commute or they commute. And this is very neat, because if I give you this operator x1 and x2, and you want to know what the syndrome is, you just look at if they commute or anti-commute instead of going to go through all the thing of the encoding and looking at the error and the decoding and what we have to do. So it's a neat little shorthand.
What if I have three zeds at that stage?
If you have z1, z2, z3, it's going to commute with both of them.
Is that an decent error?
Is what?
Is that an error which your algorithm cannot account for?
Good question. I'm going to answer in about 30 seconds. So it must be organized with the. Okay. Now this is on purpose. So we define the normalizer. Okay. N of S. Okay. Which is a set of N which belongs to the Pauli group, so that M and N, for M being part of the stabilizer, equal to zero, for all M belonging to the stabilizer. Okay? So the normalizer have a trivial syndrome. Okay? So it's 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, because they commute. And they commute, they are eigenstate with eigenvalue plus 1. So if they are errors, they are uncorrectable errors. Okay? But they can make you move within the eigenstates of the stabilizer group. Okay? In fact, if you have Z1, Z2, Z3, which acts on this, now what does Z does on the state plus?
Minus.
So if you do Z1, Z2, Z3, it is going to change this to minus, 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 and this is going to become plus, plus, plus. So it's a gate that you know very well, but it's a gate on the encoded qubit, which corresponds to what operation? This is a logical zero, this is a logical one, and I've done you an operation which changes a zero to a one and a one to a zero. What is the operation which does that?
X.
So Z1, Z2, Z3 is equal to the, I'll put this with E and C behind, is the encoded X. Good. So the normalizers has trivial syndrome, and it's got undetectable errors. If this happens, you wouldn't be able to detect them. We can use it as an operation, which is what you've done, but if we have an error which are independent from qubit to qubit, and we have the three things that happen at the same time, then you cannot detect that. Okay? In fact, NS divided by S. It's NS divided by S. It is this normalizer minus the stabilizer is as trivial syndrome, or NS as a whole is trivial syndrome, but the undetectable errors are the one which apply on this and not part of that. So what are the errors which we can detect? Okay. It can correct error in E, which belongs to the Pauli group. Okay. If for all E and F, two types of errors that belongs to E, E dagger F does not belong to NS minus S. Okay. And you can see this from that part, that equation here. This was the equation so that that you can correct the errors. So there's two cases. The first one is this is belongs to the Pauli groups. Okay? If the anti-commute with M, okay, that means that we have something like IL, E dagger F, IL, we look at the case delta I is equal to J. We have this equation. We can insert an M here because this is an eigenstate with eigenvalue M. Okay? And then because the anti-commute, we can bring it here. And then it's equal to the same thing. Okay? So sorry, I'm missing one piece. I'm going to write it. IL, be that your F. L, the anti-commute. So when I anti-commute, I forgot the minus sign. It goes there. It goes to minus IL M E dagger F IL. And M on this is equal to 1. So we have this is equal to minus IL E dagger F IL. And this is equal to minus this. So it has to be equal to 0. And this is the value of what C alpha beta is for that particular element that we come here. Okay? And then you can look at the other case when you E dagger F and M commute. And then with very similar reasoning, what you show is that EF is equal to this, means that the syndromes for E and F in that case will be identical. And so it's the same error correction procedure that you would have for both errors. And this is something that we don't see in the classical world, that two different errors can have the same correction procedure. And if you look carefully at the short code, remember that we had a triplet. Of zeros on one for the logical zero. And the same thing with the minus in here for the one. If you have an error which is z1 or z2, they both bring a minus sign here. But the same process is used to correct either of them. So there are codes. When this happens, the code is degenerate. Okay? So the last piece I want to mention on stabilizer is that there's a notion called the distance of S, which is the minimum of the weight of E. And the minimum of the weight is the number of non-identity alleles, okay? Because the unit matrix doesn't do anything. So the idea here is to find how many errors can we correct with a code. And this distance is what gives us that notion. And when we have a unit Pauli matrix, so suppose that you have an error, which is 1 tensor x tensor y tensor 1 tensor z. So the weight here will be 3. Okay. So the unit part, the identity part, you don't. So it's a weight, so that E belongs to NS minus S. So a code with distance 2t plus 1 can correct t qubits, okay, or t errors. Okay. And then you may wonder, why is there the 2 here? It's because when we have these equations here, there's 2 of those things that happen. So we need, there'll be t of those in there, and can be t. So they have 2t. And then you have to be sure that there's no overlap between these different states when you kind of apply these operators. So that's how the idea of the 2t plus 1 comes in there. Okay? So let's give some example of okay. So we say a code is a, let me make these funny brackets so that we don't look at this as commutation, NK decode if it encodes K qubits into N, N as distance D. The short code that we saw, anybody remember what the stabilizer looked like for the short code? The fog of yesterday. So you had Z1, Z2, Z2, Z3, up to Z8, Z9. So we had six of these stabilizers. And then we had X, 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 1, 1, 1. And then X, 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 1, 1, 1, X, 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 X. So similar pattern that we had for the phase error, so that's a block here, but that was correct to correct the phase errors that would come in the middle there. So we have to look at these group of operators. We'll flip all the bits and see if an error has happened, if the eigenstate has eigenvalue 1 or minus 1. Okay? So with this, we have our 9 qubits. We have 8 for the size of the stabilizer, and then that corrects for one error. The error can be 1, it can be X, it can be Z, and if you correct X and Z independently, you can show that you correct for Y also. So this was the first code that was discovered that correct for a generic 1 qubit error. Okay? And in this notation, it's called a 9-1-3 code. So if somebody gives you one of these 9 qubits in the short code, you can do whatever you want with it. And when you give it back to the person who has the other 8 qubits, they can apply their error correcting procedure and get back the quantum information. If you do this with two of them, it corrects some 2-qubit errors, but not all of them. It's going to fail. OK. Then there's a code called the Steen code, OK, which takes 7. And it's inspired by a classical coding theorist called Hamming. So there's an analog classical code to this. And you'll see it has some interesting symmetry. So I'm going to give you the stabilizer for it. And then there's a Z part, which is exactly like the X part. We get the same shape, but it's Z's instead. This one is 7 qubit, distance 1, it corrects 1 error, it corrects all 1 error, and sorry, it encodes 1 qubit and as a distance 3, so 2t plus 1 is equal to 3, which means it corrects for 1 error. And the final code is a code called a 5-bit code. Okay, and that one again has some very nice symmetry. Okay, so you start with this stabilizer, and you do some form of permutation, all of them. So if you can remember this, then you can remember all of them. So one day when you're in your deserted island, and you want to know what does the 5-qubit code book likes, you just have to remember that one. And then you can go and find what it looks like as a superposition of states. You'll just take the eigenstate, which are eigenvalue 1 of all of those. And it's possible to show that this is the smallest code that you have, that we have, that exists, that can correct for one generic 1-qubit error. So out of the 5-qubit, you can do anything you want with it, and bring it back with our correction procedure, you'll get back the encoded state the way it started. Okay. Okay. Everything I've done up to now assumed that we didn't want to do anything with our quantum computer. We just encoded the information. We just wanted to be there when we wanted to go. So in some sense, it was quantum error correction for memory. But when we encode, then there we might induce some errors by encoding. We might induce error by decoding. So how can we cope with this? And when we make gates, how do we ensure that the gates are robust, that they don't induce more errors? And so there is a piece of quantum error correction which is called fault-tolerant quantum computation, which is looking exactly at this. Now, I won't go too much in details, but I'll go through, as my usual way of teaching, I'll give you some example of how to do this. We've seen that how to do some encoded operation a few minutes ago. To do an encoded X on the 3-bit code, you had to do Z1, Z2, Z3. Okay? And the basic idea behind fault tolerance is to look at the propagation of error and ensure that the propagation is not bad. And here's what I mean by bad. That suppose that we do something with our qubit and it is encoded. I want to do my 1-qubit gate, which corresponds to an X. And then we're going to say, if an error occurs in here, is the propagation such that this error will induce even more error before we do the error correction procedure? And it turns out that this has a nice property that when I do this X rotation, it decomposes on many pieces, on 3 other rotations on each of the physical qubits, but they don't talk to each other. So if this one has an error in here, it just propagates on here. There's a one error that comes in here before or after, it just. But there's some other gates which don't have that property. So let's suppose that we want to do a control knot. Okay, between 2 encoded qubits. And now I'm going to do something a little bit tricky, but I think you can follow. Instead of looking at the plus state, I'm going to get rid of the NMR and say the only error that I have here is bit flip. Okay, so this state will be alpha 00 plus beta 111. This is the code which corrects for bit flip. And now, so here we'll have alpha 000 plus beta 111, gamma 000 plus delta 111 as one potential encoded state, but there could be a density matrix of those also. And I want to do a control knot between this and this. Okay? So how do we do a control knot? An encoded control knot. So we had ZZZ to do an X. Now if we do NMR everything, an XXX in that code will do, I think, the equivalent of a Z rotation encoded. And then you start to look at this. And I'm going to give you one way of doing it. I do this. My claim is that this is a control knot encoded. Let's check it out. So if I have a zero that comes in, the encoded zero, none of these control nodes is going to act. And so indeed, there's nothing that's going to happen to the second qubit. If I have a one, OK, it's going to flip this one, it's going to flip this one, it's going to flip this one. So it's going to flip this one, these three, and it's going to flip these three. And it's going to do an encoded version of a control knot. So this is an encoded gate of that. But in second thought, you look at this, and you'll see it's a bad way of doing it. Because suppose that there are errors. Suppose I have an error here. It's just this qubit is not getting touched. It's going to go here. And my error correction is going to do this. And I'm making the assumption here that I have an error correction procedure which corrects only for one error. Okay. If you want to do it for two errors, then I'll have more complicated. So once you understand the idea for one error, you can generalize. So if the error is here, that's OK. But if the error is here, now you remember when we were doing this conjugation, an error here, if I have a control knot with an error here, this is equivalent, when I look at error propagation, as an x here and an x here. Because the x here is going to make this flip at the wrong time and continue this. So this is going to induce an error here. It's going to induce an error here. It's going to induce an error here. This is bad propagation. So the next step is there a way to do good propagation? And I think on this one, you can find, without too much work, that if you do this, this is good. Now, you know that if there's an error here, it's going to propagate here and there. So there'll be two errors out of one error. But because these are different encoded qubits, the error correction here and this one here is going to catch it. So you'll be OK. So this kind of gate that only one qubit here talks to at most one qubit in any other block, that's called transversal. Okay. And so when we start to think about our encoded operation, we're going to look for ways which are similar to this. So ways which propagates well is really what we need. Well, if we have transversal gates, then they propagate well, it's good. Now there's a theorem which says that, unfortunately, we cannot have a universal set of transversal gate. So then we have to have some other ways of the other gates to do. Now, if I would have given this talk 2 years ago, I would have said, one obvious way of doing this is to use only transversal gate. And then you remember when we thought about quantum computing, we'd say, let's prepare zero. Let's do a computation with one qubit gate and two qubit gate. And let's make measurement in the 0-1 basis. This was our picture of our quantum computer on the first lecture that we had. Now, we can find code where we have a set of transversal gates which are part of the Clifford group. So we have a subset of these gates, okay, which have transversal property. But the Clifford group is not universal. So we have to add something. So we can add a construction to make the other gates robust. And there's a way of doing this, but I won't go into detail. Another way is to add a different initial state. So instead of preparing only zero, if you prepare a state which is pi over 8, which is cos of pi over 8 of 0 plus sine pi over 8 of 1, it turns out that adding this state preparation, then this becomes universal. And very similar to the linear optics idea, it's a lot easier to deal with imperfection of a state preparation than a gate. Because if you prepare this, you can go and check if it's OK. If it's not OK, if there's an error in it, then you don't use it. If there's no error, then you use it to do something. So you make a construction that way, which is fault-tolerant. Now, this is, again, a bit high level. But what I want to convey in here is that we have a process to go and transform gates to make them non-robust to robust to noise. And what is the implication of this to error correction? The implication is that I told you one of the effects of doing error correction is change your rate, which is P, to something which looks like CP squared. For the small code that we had there, we had C equal to 3. But once you want to do things robust, then there's many more places where error can occur because you are adding kind of different operation. You want to check different things. And so, and you have to add some qubit to preparation. And so the effect of this is to change C and make C much larger, which makes the error rate at which error correction works much smaller and make it harder than what we do in Pascal. But the idea is very similar. So it's possible to make things robust at the expense of increasing C. Now, if you change C to CP squared, it means that your probability of error has decreased. And then the number of gates that you can do reliably without error correction goes like 1 over P, right? If the error is 10%, you can do about 10 gates before you know that you're very unreliable, like back of the envelope calculation. If it is this, it tells you go to 1 over P squared. If this is smaller than this, it means you can do a larger number of gates. But you guys are really keen on doing longer and longer quantum computation. You guys say, hey, we're not satisfied with this. So there's two things I can do. I can give you some larger codes. So when you look at the classical case, we look at the 3-bit code and then the 5-bit code, where suddenly in the 5-bit code, P would go to P cubed or P5. So we can find quantum codes which have a larger distance, we can do this. But there's another way to think about it also, at least to show that quantum computation in presence of error is possible, is to think, oh, what we've done here, let's say that we've done 1, 2, 3, 4. We used a smaller code, this one, with 5 qubit. Okay? We've encoded, so the error here is P, this one is CP squared. Then we can encode them again. So each of them will have 5 qubits. So we'll go from 5 to 25. OK? And if this is smaller than that, then you'll find that here you get C cubed P4. Right? And if this is smaller than that, this will be smaller than that. And it goes down fast. Now you're increasing the number of qubits exponentially here. So you want to be sure that this goes down much faster than exponentially. In fact, if you go and look at this, it'll be doubly exponential. And these are the elements of the accuracy threshold theorem. The accuracy threshold theorem says that for some family of noise, and typically people have shown this for the depolarizing type of noise, each qubit has depolarizing noise of them. So you have an error rate P, which corresponds to the depolarizing model. If you give me a noise for the qubits, it's possible to have a construction, error correcting codes, fault tolerant gates, such that you, if you want to do a certain number of gates, AND gates, you can give you a construction which takes a number of gates which is polynomial on the original one, a number of qubits which is polynomial on the original one, and a fixed accuracy that you want. All the resources are polynomial. Then you you have this construction and get a reliable quantum computation in presence of noise. Yeah? Which is the conclusion. So noise is not a fundamental objection to quantum computing. But you have to work on the noise. You can do a little bit more work. Okay, so this is the end of the quantum error correction part. Questions?
In this notation, the NKD notation, why are we interested in saying what the distance is rather than just saying what the number of qubits we can correct it?
Because classical error correction theorists use that notion. Yeah. So it's a similar thing. So you can go in then and look at
it. But it doesn't give us any extra information. It just essentially tells us how many qubits we can
encode. So, and there's a one-to-one relationship between the two. It's 2t plus 1. Okay, so this took a few minutes more than I thought, but we still have a class tomorrow, so we're going to talk about QKD.
I have a tutorial on QKD this afternoon.
Okay.
Is it possible to cover a little bit about it?
Perfect. Yeah. I'm going to give you the main idea, and then we can. So. Go back to encryption. We mentioned encryption a little bit last week. So what is the idea of encryption? You have a key. Oh, you have a message. And you're a binary person. So whatever nice message you want to talk to your friends or your mother or your father, here's the message you want to send. And for some reason, you don't want anybody to know about the conversation with your parents. So then you have a key. Okay. With which you can encode the information. Now, there's always Alice and Bob. One of them is the parents, and one of them is one of you. And before leaving to come to Perimeter, you have exchanged a key. So you have made your random generator, you left your key with your parents, and then you have your own key. And so when you arrive here, you want to send a message saying, Perimeter is such a wonderful place, or some other opinion, and you don't want anybody to say, to see whatever you send, because you don't trust the email server, that then maybe somebody's looking at it. But because you have your key, you just take these two, and you add. And if they are the same, you put 0. If they are different, you put a 1. It's a bit like an XOR. Okay? So this is the encrypted message. Then you send this to your parents. And your parents, hopefully they have the same key. They haven't lost it. And then they get
one, zero, zero, one, one, zero, zero, one, 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 zero, zero.
Okay.
Yeah.
You said. Sorry. Do you see the three zeros?
These ones.
Too close together.
Zero, 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 one, one, zero, zero. Phew. Like, the people at the NSA were kind of going up on, like, encryption doesn't work anymore. So. Okay. So now if I hit this again, it should be the same message that was up there. Okay. So if you can exchange a key, then you can send something which is 100% secure as long as your key is really random. And that's called a Vernon cipher. So by knowing this, you can do this. The challenge is you cannot reuse your key. Because if you reuse your key, then people can look at difference between two messages. And if you look at alphabets, some letters occur more often, and then people can crack the code. So to really be 100% secure, then your parents have to be have more and more keys. At some point during the year, you're going to run out. So that might be a reason to go back home. Your parents will pay you to go back home so that you get more keys. But you see that this is not very convenient if you want to use the internet and log to your bank. You could, every morning, Monday morning, you can go and get your keys. But that might not work. It's not very practical. Interestingly, apparently, for level of diplomatic channels, people still go to the embassies in different countries with a suitcase with keys. And that's OK. Government have lots of money to send people. And they hope they trust the person who bring the keys. But if you don't, then suddenly the information can be lost. So the idea of quantum key distribution is to exchange a key without having to physically Alice and Bob to move. Okay? So you could take your key. You could imagine taking your key and sending it in the post. But somebody can snoop and look at it. So how can we do this? One way is what you've learned about factoring. There's a way to exchange a key between two people where breaking the key is equivalent to solve a mathematical problem. But we know you can get in trouble because Parameter might have a quantum computer in its basement. So if you use factoring, you have a risk of failing. So how can we do this? And I'm going to give you the idea. And on tomorrow, I'll go a little bit more in details, but hopefully you'll know enough now to get the idea of to do the homework. You remember that when you observe a quantum bit, the fact that you measure it will perturb it in general. You're going to project it in one basis or another. Okay. In the classical world, this doesn't happen. You can always measure something without perturbing it, at least to encode a good approximation. So you can never know if somebody has eavesdropped on your internet connection. In fact, you should all make the assumption that people are eavesdropping on your internet connections. In fact, the Googles of this world do on everything that you do. So, and although you indirectly know about it because there's an ad that shows up on the right at some point, and they know the ad because they've snooped on what you're doing. How can we do this quantum mechanically? And the idea of QKD is because if somebody observes a state that they don't know about, the chance it will perturb it. Now, if I send you a zero, and there's an eavesdropper and knows I'm sending you a zero, then they'll measure in the zero basis, and you will not know if they've seen it. But if they don't know if I send you a zero or a zero plus one, they won't know which basis they are looking at. And sometimes they'll measure the same basis, then you won't know. But sometimes, if it's random, they will measure in the wrong basis. And the idea of QKD is to track this. Okay. So it's the fact that when we perturb, we measure, we perturb. And here I'm looking at a little table of so we're going to have Alice and Bob. Who are going to exchange photons. Alice is going to send some photons to Bob. And she's going to send photon either in 0 and 1, okay, so, or in the state plus and minus basis, which is often called plus or minus 45 degrees, horizontal vertical for a photon. Okay. I might write H and V at some point, and plus or minus 45 degrees. So Alice is going to make herself a key. Okay, 01001 as a key that she wants to send to Bob. She's going to randomly choose a basis. And she's going to send the photon in that basis to Bob. Bob will randomly choose a basis. And he's going to make a measurement. Okay. Once he's received his photon, he can say which basis he has measured it in. The fact that you know the basis doesn't give you the value of the key, because in that basis you could have chosen 0 or 1. So Bob will say, I've looked at one particular basis, so we'll make a table. Photon number 1, number 2, number 3, number 4, number 5. Alice bit 0010010. Alice basis 01 plus minus 01. And in fact, you should meet my random number generators. Like this. Bob chose a basis. So you shout some number, zeros or one, 01 or plus minus?
Plus minus.
Plus minus?
Zero.
01?
That's going to happen.
Plus minus.
Plus minus?
Plus minus.
Plus minus?
Plus minus.
Zero.
No. Okay. Now, and you continue, and then Bob gets something, okay? Bob will get a result, and we'll see what it is in a second. She sends a zero in that basis. He looks at the different bases. So he gets his bit of information. It's 0 or 1 at 50%, okay? Sends a zero, and same thing, 0 or 1 at 50%. The same basis, then he will measure 1, 100% of the time. 01 of this, 01, 50% of the time. You guys are a bad random number generator. You're not making my life easier. Same thing here. Okay, so 1. This was different, so 50%. So he's going to get rid of this. He's just going to say to Alice, photon number 1, different basis, then the chances, I cannot assure I have the right bit. I'm going to get rid of this. This one is good, get rid of this.
How does Bob know that they measure different bases?
You what?
How does Bob know that they measure the different bases?
So Bob make a measurement. He has his basis, which is a little polarizer that he makes in front of his detector. He has a random number generator, which tells us which basis he's using, and this is what he's doing. Once he's measured, he shouts to Alice, photon number 1, which basis? Plus, minus. All right, she says 01. So he says, oh, different than what I did. Okay? Photon number 2, same thing. So he knows which basis agrees with Bob, with Alice, and when he knows it agrees, he knows he has the right result for the bit. Okay? So that way, he can establish a key. So he knows that number 3 is OK, number 5 is OK, and then he continue, and then he can take that value of the bit. That will be his key. Once he has his key, then he has his message, and then he uses the telephone or the internet, he sends the encrypted version. And so the whole point of this is that what Bob has done is that he has exchanged a key without having physically kind of move to talk to Alice or paid a courier that he trusts to make it happen. It just used the laws of physics. Now, the important point is not that he can exchange a key, but what happens when you have an eavesdropper, which is the next iteration of this. And I can take 5 minutes to explain to it. So are you ready for the tutorial? You had a question?
Yeah, I mean, it seems that Alice should tell Bob which basis she chose, and then how would she communicate that without an eavesdropper also?
The eavesdropper?
The basis, and then the eavesdropper could also give the key.
Okay. There's no information in the basis itself. Because
it allows
if I...
you to construct the key.
It's after the measurement has been made already.
Okay. So once you know the basis, you still don't know if it's a 0 and 1 on that basis. Alice is not going to tell openly what is the value that she sent with that basis, but she's just going to say which basis it is.
Okay. So the it's after the measurement, so you cannot access.
That's it. Okay. So Eve cannot go back. She would say it before the measurement, she couldn't go and put her apparatus in the middle and get the information. She does it after Bob has absorbed his photon. Okay? Now, Eve is in the middle. And I'll give you the idea, and we can come back to this tomorrow to kind of a little bit. So she will look at a basis also. And because she doesn't know what Alice's basis was, and she doesn't know what Bob's basis will be, she will randomly choose a basis here. So let's focus on these two. Let's suppose that here she takes plus minus. Now she will learn that bit. Okay? But if she chooses 0, 1 in here, then there's 50% of the chance that Bob will not get the right result. So what Bob is going to do is that he will extract the photons, or the result of the photon experiments for the one whose basis agrees with Alice. So we'll get 1, 0, 0, 1, 0, 1, 1, 1, okay? If Alice has been measuring in between, he knows that if she's there, some of these bits will get wrong. So he's gonna sample the result. He's gonna say, randomly, I'm gonna choose this one, and then I'm gonna talk to Alice openly on the open channel. On your bit number 4, what did you get? And if Alice says 4, says 1, then it works. If Alice says 0, you know that he says, oh, I didn't get the right thing. So there must have been an eavesdropper in the middle. If there's an eavesdropper in the middle, I stop, I abort, and I try again. Okay? If they all agree, then he kills that bit. He kills that bit because Alice knows it, but he can still use this. Okay? And how many bits does he need to know before he's sure or not that the eavesdropper is there? Well, this is like adding one decimal to something you want to compute, so it's exponentially efficient. So if you want to have 99.9% security, you'll have to have the log of all this number of bit, the more security you want. So the security will not be 100%, but it can be as small as you want, and as many of these comes in. Okay? So this is the basic idea of QKD. The idea is to take advantage of the fact that if you measure a quantum state that you don't know, you will project it in one of two states, and you can track this. Alice and Bob can track this, that somebody has been looking. And if somebody's been looking, you say it's corrupted, and you don't use it. If it's not been corrupted, then use it.
Even if there were an eavesdropper, say Eve, she doesn't know which bits Bob is discarding. So how could she hope to reconstruct the key, even if she is making evidence?
No, because Alice and Bob will exchange classic information about which bits to discard.
Oh, okay, right.
Yeah, so if in the case here where Alice has the same basis, then Bob says, which basis have you used, plus minus? She's used plus minus. She knows that bit is right.
But Bob doesn't make it public what basis he's chosen.
You're right.
So
but,
Eve
okay.
won't know if the basis had were any given or not. Only Bob has that information.
Make it public to Alice and discard also the bit they both have to know which bit they serve.
But Eve and Engine would only access half of the key, right?
You what?
Eve?
Even in the best case scenario, Eve would access only half of the key.
In fact, it's a quarter where things would agree. And let me tomorrow come back to these numbers. I'll answer your question a little bit better tomorrow. Say a quarter or many bits and put this together. But right now you have the idea of how it works. That is, the eavesdropper is going to try to measure. Alice and Bob sets this up. In here, what we assume is that you send one of these four states, and that's called the BB84, or Bennett Brassard, that thought about this. Early 1990s, people thought about doing similar thing, but for entangled state. So instead of sending Alice sending her information, you have a source which sends entangled photon on each side in a state 0, 0 plus 1, 1. And then Alice does the same thing. She measures in one of these two bases. Okay? And if you have the state 0, 1 minus 1, 0, the spin 0, then this whatever basis you have, you'll get 50% the same probability of getting things. Now, with the entangled state, it's even there's something which is really neat. Because the source of entangled photons, okay, can be owned by Eve. And you can verify if you violate Bell inequalities with that source. So you'll do something a little bit more here. You're going to check if it violates Bell inequalities. If it violates Bell inequalities, after the fact, after all these measurements are done, you know that Eve cannot have information. Because if Eve learns something about the Bell state, she kills the entanglement. Okay? So suddenly you can have a source of entangled photon made by the people you don't trust. And then you can still use it. And I'm happy you're smiling, because there's a very neat piece, experiments that people are doing, and Thomas Genevieve at Waterloo is trying to do this. He's saying, let's put a source of entangled photon on a satellite. And then you send the photon to two places on Earth. You can establish a key in that way, okay, on quite long distance. And you don't have to trust the satellite, because you can check if it violates Bell inequalities. And if it violates Bell inequalities, it means the satellite has no memory of the information that has been sent. And this is something we don't have in the classical world, an analog to this. So this is very neat. Now, I should warn you, the first step on this experiment is not to have an entangled source, is to have the source here and then send photons to show that can really send one photon to a satellite who's moving in the sky, catch it, and establish a key. So that's enough of a challenge as a first step. But the ultimate goal is to have source of entangled photon in the satellite. And then you can have any country that you dislike could be the provider of these photon sources, and it would be OK. And I find this pretty amazing. OK, I've taken enough of your time. I'll get back to the number and to your question of what can Alice do. Now, when you do think about these protocols, you have to think like a paranoid person. If something can go wrong, it will go wrong. So you have to be quite kind of thinking. You cannot be a goodwill person as a cryptographer. You have to be really nasty and try to break the thing all the way. all the different ways.